Well, respect is what we need right now for all the military personnel because, again, we're approaching September 11th, and the drumbeats of war are out there all over, dealing with ISIS and the stuff in the Middle East. And I thought tonight we'd have a conversation a little bit about the discussions of what are we doing to need to prepare for war, because it seems like we're heading that direction. Paul, are you with us tonight? Paul? Denise, are you there? Okay.
Well, let's carry on.
Okay, you're there, Paul. Great.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, well, Paul, I'm glad you could join us tonight. You're feeling a lot better. I mean, you know, like everybody, you went to war, and you've got the health effects, and they've been devastating on you, haven't they?
They sure have. As a classic example, I've been laying in bed all day just prior to this program.
Yeah, well, that's not good, is it?
No, it affects your whole lifestyle, everything about you, your family. Everyone, you know, it changes everything that you do.
Yeah, that becomes a critical thing. Well, you know, with September 11th anniversary come around, everybody is going back to that, and all we know what happened from that, and that's been a total disaster. We're looking at way over a million U.S. military casualties. We're looking at a million civilian casualties in all these nations affected, Iraq and Afghanistan and throughout the Middle East and all over the place. And we're looking at a devastating nightmare as far as getting medical care for everybody. And the effects, they're not only on the military personnel, but they're on their family, aren't they, Paul?
Yes. Unfortunately, that's true. Some of the illnesses that have affected the soldiers have also affected their family members, and that's not right.
You know, you could leap like all of us at once upon a time, and I wish I could do it. You could leap tall buildings at a single bound. You're up to four-story buildings. But now, as you and I both know, a single-story building is a challenge, and even getting up and moving around some days is a challenge.
That's true. And this illness, you know, some days you're not as bad as others, but there are days that you actually have to just lay around because the illness affects you so bad that you just can't, you're immobilized pretty much.
Yeah, I've got another good friend, an individual I've recently met. He was in the U.S. Navy, and he is hospitalized right now in a hospital seeking medical care. And I got an email from his wife, said, hey, Doug, if you get a chance, stop in and say hi to him, needs help, because he also was abandoned, and she was abandoned, so they're fighting it. And once they started getting some of the documents verifying the exposures and the health effects and all the stuff that went around, at least we did get them hospitalized. But there's that care, isn't out there for everybody. Denise, are you with us yet?
Yes, I am.
You know, I mean, how many times have we prepared to go for war, and how many times have we realized that we were totally not prepared to go for war?
I know. I've got an example to share with everybody on YouTube now by Mr. William Fuzzy, one of our Marines, Gulf War, called into the 800 suicide line last night, the hotline for veterans. 36 minutes on waiting time.
36 minutes waiting on the hotline?
Right.
Well, you and I have had to respond where the hotline has failed before, and we had to mobilize accents. Paul, you were involved in that, where we had to get help for everybody. I mean,
yes.
I mean,
true.
It was a nightmare where the hotline failed, and then we had to mobilize assets to get help for all our troops. And that's, I mean, where is the problem? So, I mean, if we start going to war, I mean, Denise, you and I and Paul, we've talked about this before. We don't have adequate training as far as the philosophies, the religious things, the cultural, the aspects of the Middle East, do we? I mean, we're out there, and our knowledge about that is virtually non-existent, other than the nonsense we hear, you know, and all this stuff, same thing we hear every war. And then all of the type of warfare that we're going to wage and go in there. I mean, Denise, you were at the Institute of Medicine, IOM, and, it seems like it's 14 years ago. Long time ago, where you put all the warnings and put the directives out and put recommendations together very clearly as far as what medical needs are required.
And they didn't do any of them.
Wow.
Yeah, so the question is, are they going to do them again? I mean, when we went to Vietnam, all the stuff, we didn't have, you know, we heard all the nonsense and everything we've been fed. We know today the Gulf of Tonkin incident didn't happen. None of that stuff was all made believe. We went in there. We had Agent Orange. they denied, and they still deny the correlation between Agent Orange exposures. The river rats are having a problem. The guys that were doing ranch hand are still having a problem. The guys in Korea are still having a problem. And so that never ends. And then we got the Desert Storm with all the chem bio, and you guys, I mean, firsthand experience, do not have the equipment and the training necessary, did you?
No.
I mean, that's why they brought some, they formed some little like six-person groups, and they sent them over to the Gulf trying to do some quick fixes to train everybody. It was like round robin training, you know, train the trainer, and it really didn't get down to everybody, and it was really, really a joke on the training they had. And to tell us we had the best equipment before the war, and that was available. I was going to ask you, Doug, you had an M17 mask, is that correct?
Correct. We had M17 during Desert Storm. There were a mixture of M17 and M40s issued, and then some specialized had M9s in that.
Well, did the upper echelon have the better mask?
Well, I'm not sure which one's a better mask or not, because the M40 and the M17 and the M9 all have serious leakage problems. They all have serious problems, especially the M40 mask. When you turn your head, and the silicon rubber, it starts sweating and it starts leaking.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say that one's better than the other. I would say they're a total failure all the way around. And then
I'm speaking of the M17 having the filters on the inside, and some of the mask having the filters on the outside, where all you do is you could actually hold your breath and exchange the canister, screw it in and screw it out. The filter versus having to take the mask off on the M17 and replace your filters.
Yeah, well, it doesn't quite, you know, it seems like it's okay, but it doesn't quite work as easy and as good as that. But, you know, either way, what we have, and this is one thing you talked about before when we've talked about it, the dusty agents just go right through the filters anyhow.
Oh, they can't say anything. That's why the Russians came out with a completely rubberized suit, but they soon found out that because your pores couldn't breathe, you'd suffocate.
Yeah, it was just, it turned into a nightmare.
It's a no-win situation. If you've got dusty mustard and you've got something like 3 microns, you know, going that would penetrate the filters anyway, you're going to get it.
Yeah, that's a problem we run into. So you've got all of this stuff. Medical supplies, I mean, I know being at the echelon above core in the command cell, and we were Theater Preventive Med at MedCom trying to put all this training together. Adequate medical supplies didn't exist in theater. I mean, Denise, you went over there. You were running medevac on the front line. Did you go over with the full medical supplies that you needed for the war, or did you hope and pray that they'd show up?
Medical supplies, we were pretty good, because we went to Wilford Hall and took everything we could. And so we were pretty well stocked on medical supplies, although if the war had gone longer and messier, it would have needed resupply. But we did not have our full, mop gear and all that. We didn't have enough suits and all that. So there was a problem with supplies, surely.
I mean, supplies seem to be a real problem, because they're shipping, you know, bullets and blood, or most of the time they're shipping bullets and they're talking about trying to get food. And then the other problem I think all of us ran into, and this is a thing in the Middle East that everybody keeps forgetting about, water. I mean, because of the temperatures and everything, especially in the summers, the temperatures up there, I mean, no, we were drinking 1, 2, 3 quarts of water an hour, and we weren't even peeing. In other words, the water we were consuming and using was just going away in the dodo bird, so we were on the verge of dehydration all the time. So, I mean, how do you get adequate water supplies if they're going to go into battle again? I mean, how much water do you actually need, and how much water is available? And then when you get in the medical supplies, do you even have the water available? Do you have water available for decontamination? And when I'm talking about decontamination, I'm not just talking about chemical and biological warfare agents, but in this instance, what we already have confirmation that ISIS supposedly, again, over in Syria, they were involved with chemical agents, which wouldn't surprise me. I mean, we gave it to everybody all over the place, and, you know, then they got it, whatever they could get from any other places. But then the other thing comes down to, you got all the depleted uranium munitions that the U.S. definitely will use and are using as we speak, causing contamination. And then when we start destroying the infrastructure, my God, what happens? I mean, we've got the new round now in the airborne hazards and burn pit registry and all those toxic exposures, just a whole military running around. I mean, is anybody prepared at all? Paul, what do you think the status of the 101st is?
Well, I hope it's better than it was during Desert Storm, because we didn't get any antibiotics. Everyone was supposed to have had a 10-day supply of ciprofloxacin, which was an antibiotic pill to take and for biological agents, and that never happened. And there was a lot of shortages. We had to keep getting extended on our masks because the filters on our masks, because we never got those again. And trying to decontaminate yourself was a joke. They gave you those little pads trying to wipe out your mask. Like I said last time on this show, the little plastic baffle filter at the end of the mask, you couldn't get replacements for those, and if you couldn't get that, the mask wouldn't work anyway. It was ineffective.
Exactly. That we were missing any of those also.
We never got any, and my NBC NCO, he wouldn't look me in the eye. When we got back to CONUS, he handed me a little packet that had about 50 of them in it, because he knew I was so upset over there about not getting any. I know it. That was a joke, but he felt bad about it. Then he hands them to me when we're stateside, and I'm thinking, what good's this going to do me?
You know, one of the things that's happening, all of us are kind of three old warriors. I mean, past retirement time, and it's real funny because, you know, you're looking at most of these warriors are in the age group of maybe 17 to early 20s, ideally. I mean, but with everything that's happened with the Reserve and the National Guard get called up, I mean, it's obviously you're getting the guys into the 30s or 40s or 50s, and as we know from Bowers Raiders, people in their 60s that get recalled to active duty. But your physiological capabilities have all deteriorated, and so, I mean, we're looking throughout the military where the casualty counts are astronomical. I mean, Denise, you and I followed the epidemiology, and from Desert Storm, we're way the heck over 50%, and the same thing with OIF and OEF. So you've got a very severe deficiency in qualified individuals that are healthy enough to go to war if they're going to do another war. So, I mean, where are they going to get all these bodies and these people to go in there, and what training do they have? What equipment do they have? Do they understand what they're coming up against? What do you guys think?
Well, I know that they've updated, of course, the mask, and they came out with what's called a J-list suit now that the military has available. Supposedly, it's better than the old, what we call the CPOG, the Chemical Protective Overgarment, or the MOP suit, Mission-Oriented Protective Posture Suit. They have this new J-list suit they came out with in the 90s, and I have to look at what year it was. It was around 2002, I believe, when they came out with the J-list. But I really have read the specs on it, and it really seems to have no better protection than what we had, other than it's a lighter suit.
Yeah, now the other thing, too, well, come on down, you know, when you're going to war, obviously you're going to have a helmet. I mean, you know, a lot of the Vietnam era, the World War II guys, the Korea guys, obviously the old steel pot, and then we got that plastic, the plastic pot when we got to, you know, over Desert Storm. Some had the old ones, most everybody had the new ones. And the latest stuff, when you look at Army Times, it almost looks like a football helmet. But, I mean, it comes into play, and they're going to have batteries and all these gizmos and connections. And, I mean, I know in Desert Storm, I had, you know, standard old steel pot. Boy, I tell you, I could take a bath and get cleaned up every night. I mean, it was critical no matter where you were to get clean. I mean, Denise, what is the hygiene problems without, I mean, you don't have proper clothing?
Exactly right, because when we got to our location, we didn't have any shower units. You know, I was up there running Tapline Road trying to find some shower units. Finally found them from the Army engineers that were over the ones that blew up Camisea, and they had some that they hadn't used because I guess they hadn't set EPW camp, so we got those. But then the problem was getting a water drop so you could clean up. So you're halfway decent to some degree to deal with patient care. So water was a big problem, getting a water drop up there. You reminded me of that. I was sitting here remembering things as you were talking, Doug, and I remember having to go up to up the road trying to get a water drop for us. Otherwise, we were able to, you know, get a drop from the fire trucks, but I'm sure that was tainted with other stuff. I wouldn't want to use it for too long, but they would dump their load after they were done for the day because we always had a fire truck, you know, with patients going on to the 130. How they got a fire truck up there, I don't know, but they did. But that's a standard procedure stateside, but I was surprised to see it when we showed up in theater up on Tapline. So water supply is a big need, and, you know, we were attached as support to 7th Corps and, you know, went down to COSCOM, I guess it was, down the road, trying to get water drop for us. And we were, you know, had Army people around us, too, that were, you know, the supplies were coming in there, and we would use the backhaul for the 130 to carry troops, you know, or a patient load. So water is a definite need, much less drinking water. So, you know, that is a huge need, and I saw a lot of problems with that in the first Gulf War.
Now, the other thing, too, and I mean, we've got to come back to it, all of us being medical, and Paul, you were in helicopters. I mean, we got the frontline troops out there fighting and everything else. Obviously, they're going to have their M16s or whatever they have, their M4 or whatever series they got, the 240, whatever they're going to have. They're going to have the 92. I mean, all of us, I was using an M16 and a standard old 45, actually made and issued in 1943. It's weird, but hey, you know, that's the way it goes when you go to war. And, but you got
all this. Yeah, I had one of those too, Doug.
You did too? You know, I mean, you're a nurse, that's right. Did you get, I mean, it was so strange, everybody saying, you guys are medical and you had both M16s and 45s. I thought that medics were only supposed to have 45s. Well, you know.
Yeah, everybody else was running around with Glocks and everything.
Whatever they could have.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem we run into, and to me this is terrifying, we've talked about this a lot, we talked about it the last show, firearm safety and being able to use a firearm and a gun in combat and everything else has deteriorated. I mean, you don't have the kids growing up where they have the proper training. We know that the proper training on weapons training when they come into basic training or deployment training is not there. I mean, we were having in the medical, we were lucky if we got 60 rounds per year for qualification and training. And as you guys both know, there's no way, you need 60 rounds a week to get even halfway decent, whether you're using a revolver, a pistol, or a rifle. So 60 rounds a year is useless. And then the other thing, too, is maintaining the operation of this stuff. So, I mean, it's just like, is there something wrong?
Oh, that was the other thing. You made my brain flash again. You know, we got over there, you know, M16s and 45s, and no cleaning kits.
It seems like that was the problem with the M16 during Vietnam, no cleaning kits, wasn't it?
I believe so, and that's why they jammed over in Vietnam. They would have a lot of weapons jam up on them. But, yeah, I remember hitting, when we landed in Maria and went to ESCON for 9 days, I was running around. I had a little list of things we didn't have, and I was begging from the Army left and right.
I know the 82nd and the 101st, they were deficient in supplies because they came on down to ESCON Village and ripped us off.
Yeah, and then I moved up to KKMC. I still have my little list to work on, and you know, if we had had to decontaminate any patients there on our side, if we'd gotten hit and, you know, try to decontaminate, it would have been a lost cause, you know. They didn't send us over with the supplies that they had taught about, the, you know, the chain link type cots, litters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have those. We would have had to improvise. nothing to shoot water on them. I mean, I bought some water hoses from the Saudi PX to take up. I was trying to improvise left and right. Okay, what if this happens, and what don't we have to do our job? And it was just every time I turned around thinking of another thing of how do we do this if, you know, we're up there and no resupply and we've got to handle it on our own. It was just a nightmare.
I mean, when you look at this stuff now, the other thing, too, the technology has changed. And then when you talk to these young kids and you just look around and we see that every day in the civilian world, they all want to hang all these gizmos all over themselves. So they got all this fancy technology and all they got all this other stuff. Well, then the batteries fail. And as we know, there ain't no Walmart in the desert.
No.
There's no 7-Eleven to go down there and...
You're really sore. Batteries was one thing I was grabbing when we were at Ascot Village before I moved forward. I told everybody, go get some. You're going to need it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems we ran into, and we got the word before the 12th left, and before we pulled out of Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, and then we flew into Westover Air Force Base in Holyoke, Massachusetts, Springfield, Mass., and then we went on over. I think we landed at Tarragona, Spain, and from Spain, then we went right into Riyadh. You know, when we landed, and we landed early enough to where things aren't happening. But, Denise, when you landed in Riyadh, didn't you land in the middle of a scud or artillery attack or something?
Exactly. The first scuds had gone into Israel, and the next one came in right where we had landed. That was our welcome to the war. You know, it's real.
I mean, the scuds are coming in.
You all recall about the scuds, how they didn't want to mention at first on the warheads what they would contain.
Well, they
found that rather interesting. I'm talking about just the general information that was put out, the scuttlebutt, so to speak. They did not want to mention what the warheads were capable of carrying. They wanted, and just like a few other of their munitions, like the chemical landmines they had, and they also had some chemical rocket-propelled grenades. But getting back to the Scuds, they didn't want to mention that the load for the warhead could be both chemical or biological.
And it definitely was, because we had a confirmed nerve agent and all this stuff down at Escan Village. So, I mean, we had that. There was no two ways about it.
Oh, and then they have all of our congressional investigators go on this worldwide tour. I don't know if you remember that senator out of Alabama. Was it Shelby?
Who had
them go on this merry-go-round tour to all of our allies to confirm this or that, and you know, of course, the French confirmed it, and who else was it? Was it the Czechs?
The Czechs,
and who had some of the best equipment in the world, and they already knew all this stuff, but they wanted to do all this, and I never did understand. They wasted a lot of expense and time trying to avoid this information they already knew.
Denise, you were right there when Colonel Andres Carnegie Bopp confronted him and told him exactly the truth in his full uniform at the Center for Disease Control. That was, in February of 99, and they were going bonkers.
Yeah.
You're the head colonel, a doctor, you know, in charge of all this stuff for the whole theater, confirming it all, and they're still denying it.
Well,
and they still are.
Well, they can't deny their own documents. They cannot deny their own memorandums to state that this was confirmed and that they've confirmed it and that they've checked blood out and they've found antibodies to these exposures. I mean, you know, you might have antibodies to anthrax from the shots or something, but you're not going to have it. You're not going to have to all these other exotic biological exposures. I'm sorry. I don't think I got any shots or anything for that.
Yeah,
as well as you all.
It turned into a nightmare because I know there were so many people that arrived sick in theater, and then people got sick right afterwards just acclimating and everything.
Right. Some were evac'd out of theater. That's true.
Denise, how long does it take to acclimate to water and food changes and everything else? Does that happen, or is it a nightmare?
It's a nightmare, and it takes longer than 30 days, I would say.
Well, they wanted to give you about, I believe it was 7 to 10 days, at least with the 101st, to acclimate. And some of the water we got, it was called Royal Gift Water on this memorandum, and it turned out they tested it. It was from the Saudis, and it was called, in the quotes of the memorandum, Royal Gift Water, and it turned out that it had feces in it. and waste, human waste.
We ran into that problem, and that was, see, the Saudis and everybody else, they have what they call night soil, so they collect all of that, and they use it on the food and vegetables. I mean, that's why we had all of the diarrheas and the constipation and everything else and the dysentery. I mean, that turned into a real nightmare. We had entire units that go on down, much less the biological agents. I mean, when the Bacillus globigi landmines hit the 801st MPs as they came out of the POW camps up north of, right north where you were, Denise, at Long Base Charlie, I mean, that turned into a friggin' nightmare. I mean, where do you get all of these IVs to handle all this stuff? I mean, simple food poisoning and all this stuff, much less the biological agents, you're going to have IVs. But, I mean, where is all the IV supplies going to come from?
The Red Cross.
I didn't see the Red Cross in theater until we started retrograding.
That was tongue-in-cheek, by the way.
Well, let's come back. What they're talking about was on the news earlier today. I mean, talking about all the airstrikes and artillery strikes. I mean, I spent my early days on B-52s back in the Vietnam era, and I knew at that time we could bomb all day long, and all they did was go in their hole and come back out later on. With the Apaches, Paul, you were on – Apaches are a frontline fighting airship, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yes, and you, there's two versions that the Apaches were the first ones to hit an anti-radar site to start the war, and then I've also heard that actually it was the Navy who fired the first shots of the war. So there's actually two different versions of who fired the first shots from the United States Armed Forces. Why it's conflicting, I don't know. Maybe the historians need to get together. But,
yeah. Well, yeah, with the weapon systems on the Apaches, they're not going to be much good at hardened facilities or anything, are they?
No. No, they're not. Well, it depends on how hardened the facility is, of course, but if it's deep underground, I don't see how it's going to do it unless they just, you know, get lucky and can fire like a Hellfire missile or something right into the hole in the ground or one of their caves.
So the Apaches are primarily a ground forces attack tool, so they're just going to go and sweep and get those guys in an unprotected posture. But, I mean, what are the ranges and everything else, and how much can you do? And, again, where do you get all the fuel, and how do you get all this put together? And then,
not like that, but your rescue. I mean, what do they have that could shoot down the Apaches and the C-130
gunship? Surface-to-air missiles would shoot down the Apache, unfortunately.
Huh?
Surface-to-air missiles would shoot down the Apache very easy. I mean,
well, an RPG, if it hits it, it's taking it right down.
Well, sure.
Small weapons
I mean,
fire.
There's a lot of munitions that are out there. I'm trying to remember what we supplied the Afghans with that took the Russian helicopters out that we actually left them with, the CIA. Do you remember that?
Well, we sent them a lot of RPGs that we captured from the Iraqis, plus we had all of the, handheld U.S. missiles and everything else that we'd sent to them.
I was thinking of that particular one where it was, I cannot recall the nomenclature on it. It would actually fire, I mean, you just pointed at the bird and it could take down a plane because it followed the heat signature.
Well, that's a Stinger missile.
Was it the Stinger that was handheld?
Yeah.
Okay, the shoulder fired. Okay. Okay, so Stinger would take down the Apache, I mean, if they had something like that.
You know, so you're coming in there. But then the other thing, too, and I mean, all of us have been over there, and I mean, Denise, being a female and, you know, right up front, I think you were a major at that time before you ended up, you know, getting out medically and retiring. But what are the philosophies and the social and cultural things? I mean, we've gone in there for years and years and years, and what we've intervened in their everything in their lives and changed everything. And my question is who is who over there, and how do we know who our friends are and who they want us there, and if they even want us there, or, you know, what happens? I mean, you're going in there one minute, and it's a good thing in the next moment you figure out, wait a minute.
Well, you know, I have to say one good thing about the administration, and people fight us on the administration currently. But I think they're trying to get the Arab countries to come in strong so that we're not the only ones there, you know. And I do believe it takes the Arab countries coming together to deal with this issue we have over there now. I mean, we've provided training, we've provided equipment, and it's time for the Arab countries to, you know, stand up and deal with this stuff. And we'll back them up, you know, with the needs they have. But, you know, there is a need, and, you know, everybody's pushing us to do this and that and go over there and, you know, do everything. And I'm going, whoa, let's give it a time to get an Arab coalition together, and
right.
we back up them. I mean, I'm tired of America taking the weight of everything all the time.
Well, it's right in their back door. They need to, just like I think it was, who was it, King Fahd said that he expected an attack here in the next month in Europe and 2 months in the United States from ISIS. And that was on the news here very recently. That's open source news. And probably
well,
saw it with our
I wouldn't
open
put
borders.
It past them to have something happen in Saudi or Jordan.
Well,
no.
England is taking away, Great Britain's taking away all of the passports of anyone who's left there,
yeah.
anyone over there, and I don't think our government's acted on that yet, and that's a good idea.
I think it is. Just, you know, hold right. those passports and say you don't get back in if you've gone over
right.
that part of the
yeah.
country.
Yeah, but they could still sneak back through our open south border, unfortunately, if it's still as porous as what it was reported here about a month ago.
You know, you got all that stuff, but we got to come back to it. I'm going to come back to the fundamental thing. If you want to get an Arab coalition, okay?
Right.
And my question I have, and this is what we ran into before, is they all talk as ISIS or something, as some abstract force or something outside there. But these are basically Iraqis or Kuwaitis or from Syrians or Turks or anything else. So these are the individuals that are living there. It's not like it's some foreign force that all of a sudden materialized. These are the people that are living there. They're kind of, seem to me, in a sense, fed up with everything that's been coming on. Because I think, if I remember, Saddam was a Sunni and all this was tied together. Sunnis had control of Iraq.
Right.
You had the Shiite population that was kept under control.
Which was the majority, though.
Again, the majority. And now you got the Shiites that are now in control. And everything is coming apart. And at the same time, now they're slamming dunk on the Sunnis. But now you have a mixture, and we have to come on back, is when the U.S. comes in or NATO nation or foreign nation comes in, it doesn't matter to me from what I understand, whether it's Sunni or Shiite or whatever. Then they come on the Arab and they go, wait a minute. This is the U.S. or Britain or whatever, Germany or whatever nations coming in, telling the French, coming in and tell us what we want to do and how we're going to do it.
Well, I remember General Colin Powell at the beginning of Desert Storm saying, we're going to cut the head off of the snake and what it, for victory. And I believe Syria is the key. We've got to go into Syria with boots on the ground and take them out.
For what purpose, though?
Because that's where all of their major bases are.
Well, they're all over. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. But, I mean, the question is, so what? I mean, this isn't, you know, we're looking at historical things, and this is the thing that I've got to struggle with, and I think all of us have to struggle with. We're looking at things from an historical point of view, saying, well, if you have control of this ground in this city, but when you look at political ramifications and philosophical ramifications, isn't it who controls what ground or whatever, it's what do the people think and how do they believe and where are they going? And so
I want to ask the question of you two. Have you had thoughts in the last several months watching this, wondering if we should have just left them alone and never gone over there? I mean, Saddam was a bad guy.
That is, you know, there's something to that, because if you take these despots who ship people back, protesters back to their family members, chopped up in pieces in a box, and then they make them still pay for the burial. That is one of the traits, unfortunately, that's over there. And I don't want to go into naming countries or groups, but I'm talking about studies I've got on Saudi, and well, I'm talking about Arab philosophy, and they recognize force. That's all. That's the major thing they recognize, is overwhelming force, and they will abide by that. And you take a strong man like that, he can keep his country together. We may not like their way of doing it. We may not appreciate it. We know they have no realization of human rights. But
So trying to go over there and take these...
It takes a madman, basically a dictator, to keep their countries intact.
And taking the bad guys out when they've never had freedom, I mean, and liberty. I mean, it was like, Bush was saying we're going to plant freedom all over the world, and I'm going, look what we've got now.
I heard the other day that the only actual free country over there, is Israel and that whole part of the world.
Not really. Israel has been, putting everything together and all this stuff on the stuff they've been doing with the Palestinians from day one has been a nightmare. So they've got the incredible blockades and food embargoes and supply embargoes and everything.
Right.
It's been going on forever. They still got the camps that they put together when they forced people out. And then they've used illegal weapons. I mean, we confirmed this. I mean, Denise, you and I were at the IOM meeting in Washington, D.C., when a sergeant major from the White House confirmed that Israel had used and verified it with photographs and medical evidence that Israel had used depleted uranium in the 73 war against the Egyptians. Remember that?
Yep, I remember.
I mean, that was just kind of like, and I remember Harold Sox and everybody freaking out, and our good old buddy Mikey Nalen and Admiral Mazumdar didn't like it.
But, I've sat here and had a lot of wondering of if we started the whole thing by taking out the bad guys and trying to plant a new system.
Now, look, though, if you're talking about Desert Storm, If he went on into Kuwait, which he did, I mean, where would he have stopped? I mean, if he went into Saudi Arabia, Saddam Hussein, and started controlling the majority of the oil,
back on April Gadsby, the wink April Gadsby gave him of no treaty obligation.
Bottom line is, if we'd had a status of forces agreement in Iraq, right now, this wouldn't have happened, in my belief.
I'm not sure we would, because what we're seeing, and this come down to the reality again, the same thing. The Iraqis and everybody are fed up with the Western intervention that's been going on there since 1900, 1917, with the Sykes-Picot Treaty, when the French and the British decided to divide up all of these areas and create these nations.
Right.
And take control of it for the resources. I mean, that's what the Sykes-Picot Treaty in 1916, 1917 was about. And that's why Lawrence of Arabia got so fed up and walked out on it, because he realized after what he had set up and got, all these guys fighting against the Turks and the Germans,
right,
that it all fell apart in the end, and the French and the British were just going to take it over and run it.
Well, they didn't consult the local populace on where they would like to have their country's boundaries at. They drew the line in the sand themselves on a map and said, this will be this country and this will be that country. And that really didn't sit well with them.
And yeah. They didn't know the different, what should I call them, tribes?
Exactly. I mean, you've got over 100 different tribes in Iraq alone.
Yeah.
So I mean, they didn't stop to consider any of that when they parceled out the boundaries.
See,
why I'm saying it's got to be an Arab coalition that leads it this time, and we provide.
I'm all for that, but we've still got to lead. We cannot lead from behind. That does not work.
No.
We have got to have boots on the ground.
Yeah,
we have to keep a presence there. Earlier I was saying we needed a status of forces agreement, which I still believe we should have had, and not just left Iraq like it was, because I think we could have held that country together. They needed leadership, and their former leader, he was not doing them right anyway. He was a Shiite and not letting
resisting.
Any of the Sunnis
the one resisting the agreement to leave forces there. He resisted that.
Who?
The former...
Are you talking about Malachi?
Yeah.
Well, here's the deal.
That.
We should have insisted upon it. I was told by certain sources that our country didn't push hard enough for a status of forces agreement.
Yeah, but Paul, we're sitting at philosophies, and this is the thing that bothers me, and it bothers me all the way from Vietnam to this day. What right do we have to occupy any foreign nation whatsoever anyhow? I mean, we can have a status of forces and say we're going to be here to keep under control for you. But is it to keep under control for them, or is it to keep under control for us in order for us to gain the resources that they have available? I mean, Desert Storm was lock, stock, and barrel done again to get the oil control back under the U.S. and the French and the British. And then when we look at the same thing going into Syria, I mean, you got the Gazprom pipeline that's got to come across out of Iraq through Syria to the Mediterranean. And then you've got all the oil wells and the gas wells in the Gaza Strip that Israel and the U.S. and the British and the French want control over.
I guess it is a perplexing situation. There may not be a short answer to that, Doug. I know that with all the different tribes and their beliefs, and of course you've got the majority of them being Sunnis and Shiites, but it is a complicated situation. And I'm not saying if we had indeed had a forces agreement, a status of forces agreement in Iraq, that there would still be bombings and what have you. But they really went down quite a bit after our forces were there and things started working. I mean, they were starting to create what we would call a society. But when we pulled out, things went to chaos.
Well, they had an incredible society before all this stuff started. Iraq had a world-class medical and education system. They had a world-class industry.
But that was under a dictator once again.
Pardon me?
That was under a dictator once again.
Well, again, the question is the dictator by our definition or a dictator by their definition?
You know, strictly by ours, because they didn't know anything else. So some people could argue we shot ourselves in the foot when we got rid of Saddam, because he did hold that country together by whatever means.
You know, so now what we're heading to is another part of the story, and I think this is the critical issue on the whole thing. We're sitting here debating and discussing this stuff. Well, now all of us that have gone to war and been involved in this stuff and done stuff, had to treat casualties and had our buddies die and get sick, and we've watched our health deteriorate and everybody else deteriorate. Now you come back and you got the psychological thing in the brain where you got the ethics and the moral questions, and this is driving the PTSD. So if we get involved in this again without some solid rationale, some without solid justification, without a solid end game, do we end up creating an entire another what I call a Gulf War III,
right?
An entire another generation where we know we have over 300,000 out of 600,000 300,000 still living, over 300,000 for sure confirmed by the Griffiths Report, the VA are seeking medical care at Desert Storm. That's over 50% still alive. We know we're at 50 to 60% casualty rate and all of the incredible problems for OIF-OEF. So how many times do we go and how many more casualties do we create? And then what do we do when we do it? Because we sit there and argue amongst ourselves, well, we should do this or we shouldn't do this or we should go on in there and we're right and we're justified to do this. But then you come on back down, and I think the PTSD and the ethical and moral crisis that everybody's dealing with is really, what right do we have? Are we justified in doing anything? What is the outcome? Is the outcome for betterment for humankind and their life and their society? Or is the outcome for economic and power and growth and greed?
That's a very good question. And I think that's way above my pay grade.
Well, you know, I don't have the answer to it, but I mean, that's what's affecting all of us, and that's what's affecting everybody. Because when I talk to the kids, and when I mean kids, I mean people our age or whatever, all of us are sitting there scrambling the whole thing. Well, what did we do, and what did this gain, and why did we do it? And now these are the consequences I have. And as Paul, you and I have talked, Denise and I, you have talked, you know, I've talked forever, and we've helped everybody all over we could. Everybody's got a question. Well, you know, we went to war based on this rationale and to do this mission. And we thought that after once we got wounded, ill, sick, or injured, that the military and the government, in other words, Uncle Sam, was going to take care of us. And as coming out day by day, we're finding out day by day the abandonment is worse than ever imagined, whether it's on active duty or within the VA. The abandonment is absolutely staggering.
It is. It really is. I don't have an answer why why the VA is not doing what they should. I think they just had some more resources appropriated to them after this investigation, if I'm correct, of several billion dollars where these veterans died because they were neglected care. And I believe you told me the other day you knew one personally who was trying, or you knew some personally who was trying to get care, and they could not receive it. Is that correct, Doug?
Well, absolutely happened. I mean, Denise and I, you and I did that report. If you remember, we tried to get Bowers Reeder and the DU team. We had 434 individuals involved with the DU team during Desert Storm. And even the VA has claimed only a handful of people ever got care and treatment, and we know way too many individuals, whether the DU team or otherwise, that were there and did the mission, and they never got the medical care, and they died. I mean, that's a given fact of reality, and in fact, Bernie Rotzker, I mean, when I asked for medical care for the DU team, and Denise, we put that report into that report we wrote for the House Oversight, actually sent a message back and said, we're not going to give these guys care, and it's not our responsibility. And I mean, it's like,
you're telling me about that letter, Doug. That is just unbelievable. To me, that's treason to our veterans. That really is. I mean, putting it in writing that you're not going to take care of sick vets who were injured from exposures that occurred over in the Gulf, and just stating outright that you're not going to take care of them.
Well, that was the internal memo Bill Eddy gave us too, wasn't it, Denise?
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. Unbelievable. You know what? If prospective recruits knew of that, because everyone, and I was under the false belief, and I told you this, I said I wasn't worried any time I got hit or anything over in the Gulf War, because I know Uncle Sam would take care of us. And we saw that we had to put public pressure on both, at that time, the Department of Defense and VA, to get treatment for us. And I don't know what the outcome's going to be. I hope that the OIF veterans will get together and form a coalition and for those who are ill and address their grievances publicly so the press can put it out and we can know where they stand.
Well, the Institute of Medicine, I know, Denise, you were involved in this report. The Institute of Medicine came out, about a year and a half ago, where they confirmed that the toxic exposures affecting Desert Storm vets are the same as the toxic exposures affecting OIF-OEF, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, in fact, I was just posting a letter that somebody had sent that's from 2010, listing the exposures for OIF, OEF, had Camp Lejeune and some other things on there. But they didn't mention a whole lot on the OIF, OEF, except for the burn pits, a particulate matter that's over there. Really, you know, didn't cover some of the things I feel they should. And I just posted that on Gulf War Illnesses. I found a link to it from another site. And I was reviewing that as we were talking, and it really is not thorough enough to cover all the exposures that the troops in OIF and OEF had. Didn't even mention DU.
What is interesting, I've got a memorandum somewhere around here in my office where it states that when the OIF veterans came back, they were receiving the same physical as we did pertaining to exposures.
Unfortunately, they weren't, because one of the things in the GAO confirmed, you know, Denise, you were totally involved in this, getting the Department of Defense to put together the post-deployment physical assessment form 2796. And we know, again, in my son's own case, his commander refused to do it, even with congressional impact, and he refused to do it over and over again. But not only did they refuse to do that post-deployment physical, then those that they did do, the GAO has confirmed again that they were disappearing. And so when the guy goes to put in their claim, they don't have any evidence, and then line of duty report. I mean, Denise, I mean, with all the casualties that you saw and everybody, how many line of duties did you generate, or was the unit supposed to generate?
That was the thing. You know, they didn't know to get a line of duty. Reserve guard.
There was no paperwork that came back.
Reserve and guard didn't know to put in for line of duty, so they, you know, were hit. You know, it's the active duty. We know from Paul it wasn't done right.
we had no paperwork was generated. No paperwork was generated, or it never made it back here to the United States. Now, that's in hearings, and that's also in memorandums.
Yeah.
Well, I'm talking about, and I'm also talking about after-action reports. They state, these after-action reports put out by the Department of Defense states that there was no paperwork for them to follow up on when doing some studies because they didn't have any paperwork to start with pertaining to the exposures.
Well, we know they had the paperwork, but, I mean, Denise, you were there at the CDC when Colonel Bott point-blank stated that they filled the Conex, and when it got back, the Conex was empty.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
And then we know the chemical logs, we know those were ordered destroyed because we got involved in that during the hearings and the testifying before the Shays Commission, that the order to destroy the logs went down to Florida, and they destroyed them. Because Sergeant Major that was involved in it called us and said, now what do we do?
Well, I've still got the op plan for Desert Storm because I got a copy from the 101st. When all of a sudden my units and then my brigade's paperwork started disappearing on the operational logs where we got gassed and what have you, they disappeared. And I was talking to an older sergeant. He told me, he said, go down to the museum and see what they have. And sure enough, I went down there, and they had file cabinets for each war, starting with World War II, and they were about, six drawers high. And later on, I went in there, after I'd copied everything, I went in there just to see how the employees were doing, the civilians, and they said, Sergeant Lyons, you got it just in time. And I said, well, what are you referring to? They said some people from DOD came in there and grabbed the whole file cabinet and wheeled it out. And this, I'm talking about a heavy file cabinet, too. And I couldn't believe it. I don't know what happened to it after that.
And that's why we've been so delayed, is it started with the records vanishing. You know,
well, I've had soldiers' medical records disappear. I started copying mine every chance I got. I went in one time, and they said, oh, by the way, your records disappear. And they start looking around, skirmishing, going crazy. And I was just as calm as I could be because I said, hey, that's fine. I've got a copy at home. I'll burn it off and bring it back to you. 5 minutes later, they found it.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they wanted to see my response, like, oh, my God, this is it. You know, no, it wasn't it. I had a complete copy. Up to date, and I would have burned it all off and given it right back to them.
I guess what I'm looking at, we're talking about airstrikes and everything else, and we're going to be destroying the infrastructure of all these nations, spreading contamination all over the place. And then if we do put boots on the ground, how are we going to prepare and properly protect everybody, much less the U.S. military, any coalition military we have? And then what the heck are we going to do with all the civilians? Because if you contaminate and trash an area,
right.
What good is that for anybody then in the future? I mean, that's what's happened in, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Iraq. I mean, all around Basra, it's an environmental radiological wasteland because of the highway of death.
Right. And then you take Kuwait, where they had civilian contractors going there to clean up all the depleted uranium.
Yeah, they brought that all back to Boise, Idaho, by the way, and put it at American Ecology. We wrote that plan. I was involved in writing that plan. We wrote that plan in December of 1992 while we were at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Research Lab in Champaign.
Wow.
General Greenberg came back down and said, hey, guys, you got to write the plan to clean this up, and we did. And it was passed up through the, our military chain, went over to Madeleine Albright, and then from there it went to the Emirate of Kuwait, and it was all written for Halliburton, Kellogg, Broad, and Root.
Once again, the contractors make the big cash in the green bucks, don't they?
Fascinating.
I have to throw something out. And is some of this crazy ISIS behavior due to exposures?
Hold on. You're saying that they're upset because of exposures?
No. I'm saying is some of the weird, outrageous behavior of ISIS possibly due to some of the overall exposures over years and years of exposures over there?
I think they're just nuts, personally.
Yeah, I can say they're just nuts, but I, being a medical person, I'm wondering, boy, they lived in that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's a thought. That's a theory. One theory to throw out, yeah, but I was hearing the other day on testimony where they've got this doomsday doomsday scenario in their mind, you know, that we're in the end times, and that's why they're such extremists, and they want to bring about the caliphate, and what is it, the 12th Imam, and they expect it to happen, and during our time, during I guess the next year or two, according to them. Personally, I say let's get some air support, let's get a coalition with our Middle Eastern partners, and boots on the ground, and let's just stomp them down like you would a roach.
You know, but what will that achieve? And I mean, again, the same thing. When we did the same thing in Vietnam, and we bombed, and nothing happened. And
they don't have anything to hide behind. There's very little cover in the desert. You know that. I guess that's what I'm getting at, is that crazy philosophy they're trying to convert everybody over to is, it keeps appealing to certain people for some reason, even some Americans, and that's what really blows me away, and Brits, you know, and I don't know where they're coming from. I mean, I've studied certain parts of their religion, but it's not the extreme part that they're studying, and then trying to convert Christians or kill them, and then putting children's heads on stakes. You know, pikes. I don't have any. You know, these people need to be erased from the face of the earth. They need to be a footnote in history, and that's it.
Yeah, you're getting down to the fundamental question again, and I think that's what we have to face, and that's what we have to look at.
We don't have, you know, as war weary as this country is, we are a superpower. We are the superpower. We don't have the luxury of sitting around and waiting. And letting them get something like a nuclear bomb or something. We don't have that luxury. And if they come over here and they believe in all the suicide attacks, and they come over here to the United States and start doing this stuff, you know, it's going to really, a lot of people are going to be upset because we could have stopped them over in the Middle East.
Well, guys, we're getting down to the last 4 minutes, so.
Yes, we are.
I want to encourage our Gulf War vets, if you have problems, PTSD, I recommend the vet centers. They're all over the place, more locations than the VA hospitals are probably closer to you. They're very good. Get some help. Know about the Gulf War illness. Ask to be referred to the war-related illness centers. Don't delay anymore. It's time to get it on and get taken care of.
Excellent, excellent idea.
Again, we're moving forward. We're having a conversation. We're trying to line up some individuals that can speak about the Islamic ideas and find out what's happening from that perspective, too. Hopefully we can get that lined up. Well, take care, everybody, and thanks again, Paul. Thanks, Denise. A good conversation, and I don't think we got any answers or anything, but at least we asked the question.
Great discussion, stuff.
Okay, thank you. God bless, everybody. Take care.
Bye.